The Bucks are about to become the only NBA team with an alternative court. How is that significant? Matt Velasquez and Charles Gardner have the answer later in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for joining me. Many listening today may recognize Tom Murray's name. Tom was a reporter for TMJ4 for more than 8 years. What has he been up to since he left the station? Reporter Bill Glauber found out.
Tom has made a career and life change of course. For 8.5 years, he was at WTMJ-TV. He signed off the air for the last time in the middle of August. And now he is an associate pastor at the Oak Creek Assembly of God Church.
What motivated Tom to make that career shift?
Tom had been thinking about it, he said, for about 2.5 years, and he's been studying towards it and decided this is where he wanted his life to go. He has a wife, 2 young children, and he is very devout, and this is what he wants to do in the next chapter of his life. It's really, you know, remarkable to meet a person who actually knows what they want to do and then goes out and does it.
That's true. It seems like that's a little hard these days. Now, what was the most interesting part of interviewing him?
I think the most interesting part of interviewing him was actually Tom's reaction. I don't think he's ever been interviewed. And, you know, it's a unique experience for a news reporter to be on the other side. And, you know, this is, you know, Tom opened up about, you know, the reasons for doing this, about his faith. You know, he's a man who, as a newscaster, was, you know, totally in the center of things and told both sides of the story. And so it was a little unique for him to actually be answering the questions.
Is there anything about his career in television that he misses?
You know, I don't think he does. I really don't. I don't, you know, all people in TV especially, there is an ego part of that. But I think he's very comfortable with what he's done and with the direction his life is going. And I think he really wants to make the most of it ministering to people. And, you know, he has a unique opportunity. It is a very large church out there, lots of families, lots of young people, and he seems to fit right in.
And it's interesting, too. I was looking at his Facebook page. It seems like he's actually talking about this very thing a lot. He's talking about the way that faith can tie into careers.
Well, he's been giving talks on that as sort of his first sets of talks at the church, and you know, taking Bible verses and trying to apply them to everyday life lessons of work, and you know, it's a new thing for him, and I think I sat in on a class. He seems to be doing quite well with it.
As a journalist, what's it like for you when someone opens up about something that's so personal, like faith?
I take everybody at their word on their faith, and, you know, I listen, and it's kind of remarkable to hear people open up. A lot of people don't want to discuss that, and, you know, when you get the opportunity and when you get to talk to somebody like Tom, who obviously is a communicator, it's a very interesting thing to hear it from really a news reporter's side. He's a newsman still in his own way, and you know, he's coming to grips with a lot of things, so it's quite interesting to hear.
If you're interested in learning more about Tom Murray, look for that story in coming days. Chicago is known for many things. It's electrified blues, it's mobsters, for better or worse, and for some, it's known for its architecture. Art critic Mary Louise Schumacher recently traveled down to the Windy City for the Chicago Architecture Biennial event. What she came back with is a story about how architecture is changing and how the city is attempting to change with it.
Well, I mean, it's been billed as the first ever North American survey of contemporary architecture, so I mean, it was really interesting. There were journalists there literally from all over the planet. There's really only one other exhibition even like this, really, and that's the Venice Architecture Biennale, which is, you know, on the other side of the planet. So it was a very big occasion, and it's a very big you know, attempt by the city of Chicago to remain relevant within the field of architecture, you know? So Chicago has always been this laboratory for architecture. It's a city that's known for architecture. You can take, you know, dozens upon dozens of tours of the city on bicycles or in buses or boats to explore that legacy, you know? And it's known for it's, you know, the Bauhaus school. It's known for pioneers like Mies van der Rohe and Frank Lloyd Wright. But, you know, the question is, where is that field going now and what is Chicago's place within that dialogue? So this is a real serious bid to be at the center of the discussion about architecture. It's all over the city. So there's kind of a really big exhibition hall right downtown. The exhibition takes over the Chicago Cultural Center, which is kind of close to Millennium Park. And, you know, that's this beautiful old building that is kind of a symbol in a way of aspirational architecture. I mean, it was a building that signaled Chicago sophistication in the Gilded Age. And it's just sort of dripping with beautiful mosaics and the world's largest stained glass Tiffany dome. I mean, it's really beautiful. And so that has been completely taken over by this major exhibition. And then the biennial spreads out from there. So there are exhibitions in Millennium Park. There's an exhibition on the south side. There are several satellite sites all over the city. It would take days, really, to see the whole thing.
And what were some of the important takeaways from this?
I think for me, the real takeaway was something we sort of already know, which the field of architecture has swung away from these, you know, star architects like Frank Gehry and Santiago Calatrava, who we know here in Milwaukee, and they're kind of art object-like buildings, to a discussion about what's going on in the world today. So, you know, I was mentioning how beautiful and luxurious the cultural center is, this main site for the exhibition. You walk through the lobby, and it's kind of, you know, decked out with these gorgeous Dwell magazine, you know, worthy rocking chairs and bright white and yellow furniture. And then you go into the actual exhibition, and one of the first things you see is a project by Studio Gang, a very famous, you know, respected architecture firm in Chicago, that addresses police violence and the shooting of unarmed Black men in the United States and the architecture of law enforcement. So right away, you see that there's this sober shift that we all know has existed in the field, but you really feel that in this exhibition. So there are 120 architects or firms from around the world, and many of them are really using design and architecture to address critical problems in the world, like poverty, inequality, climate change, issues related to race. So that really came through for me.
So in neighborhoods that lack resources in terms of architecture or urban design, mm-hmm. what were some of the elements you could pull from this show and you know, other cities could try to incorporate into neighborhoods that are lacking those resources?
Well, there was a huge emphasis on housing, you know, for low-income housing, for housing in disaster areas in the world. And there were some really beautiful examples of that within the exhibition. I think one of the projects I was most inspired by was the Stony Island Arts Bank, which is actually a physical project on the south side of Chicago in the Grand Crossings neighborhood. And it's a project of Theaster Gates, who is a Chicago artist. A lot of people in Milwaukee will know him because he had an early and important show at the Milwaukee Art Museum in 2010. But what he does is, you know, he has rejuvenated several properties on the south side. And what he's really trying to do is bring architecture of significance, kind of a high art attitude, into the everyday, you know, in neighborhoods that are distressed and what he actually called the hood. I mean, he told these journalists from around the world, like, hello and welcome, you're in the hood, and make no mistake. So it's a struggling neighborhood. It's a mostly Black neighborhood. And what he did is he took this old bank that was literally underwater and decaying, like the entire basement was underwater, and there's a beautiful old safe down there that's just decayed and gorgeous. And he turned this into an art center and a place where archives related to Black culture can be housed and where art installations can happen and people can come and hear music. And it's really, you know, so you have these like journalists from all over the world, most of them are white, in this Black neighborhood, and those things sort of go together really beautifully there. So I don't know that that is translatable to other cities. I mean, I think the real trick with a project like that is you have a visionary artist kind of driving the bus. And so one of the questions I asked as I was coming home from the biennial is, you know, who is Milwaukee's Theaster Gates? Does Milwaukee have a Theaster Gates? I mean, that's why some of these projects are so rare.
Now, you started off your story by posing a question, which was, is good architecture a fundamental human right?
I did, yeah.
What do you feel on that?
Well, I do think it's a fundamental human right. I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of a funny question to ask, and I know that it's going to get a reaction from readers, because when you think about architecture and the dialogues around architecture, so much of it is related to the fussy aesthetics of the field, right? So, but architecture is also about, where do we put the sewer lines? What are the housing covenants in our city? Is there redlining going on? You know, and are we designing, is the physical design of our space and our civic environment equitable? I think it's good for us to think in those terms. I think it absolutely is. And I think architects today really are thinking in those terms, which is great.
So for someone who wanted to go down and check out this biennial, what would be some travel tips or planning tips you have?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I was overwhelmed. So I was there for 2.5 days. I did not see all of it. I've done the biennial thing all over the world. I've been to Documenta. I've been to the Venice Biennale. I've been to the Armory Show. I mean, I've done this for a long time, and I still find it really challenging. And I think this exhibition will be challenging for a general audience. So I would offer a couple of tips. One is, you know, to put on what I often call the biennial brain. You know, like, you've got to be in the mindset to see this much work. It's so expansive, and it can be a little overwhelming, and you might be tempted to rush your way through it. And I think you've got to give yourself, like, have a little pep talk with yourself and give yourself the time to really take in what you're looking at, what's in front of you, and to give that thing a fair shot. And as soon as you know you're not interested, move on. But to slow down and really allow yourself to experience the things that are in front of you. And know that you're not going to see it all, that you need as much time to consider what you've seen as to look at what you're seeing. So take breaks, go have coffee, go talk to your friends. Maybe if you're from Milwaukee and going to see it, maybe you go down a couple of times. It's open through January 3rd, so, you know, I'm planning to go back a few times to see it again and again and see some of the things that I didn't in the first pass through. So that's always a good way to do it, too, is to take it in, to sip it rather than to gulp it, if that makes sense.
If this segment has piqued your interest, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit tapmilwaukee.com. You'll find Mary Louise's story there. GE recently announced a plan to lay off 350 people in Waukesha. Why? The company was unable to secure underwriting from the U.S. Export-Import Bank. Here's business reporter Rick Barrett with a look at the U.S. Export-Import Bank and its role in employment in southeastern Wisconsin.
Could you explain what the U.S. Export-Import Bank is, and how it's supposed to function, and how it actually functions?
The U.S. Export-Import Bank is essentially a federal agency. And what it does is it helps U.S. companies that sell their products overseas by underwriting the financing to their customers.
And so if you are an organization or a business in Wisconsin, and you needed some government underwriting, what would be some of the qualifications you would have to meet in order to earn that?
The way it would work is that the bank approaches it pretty much like an insurance company or like another financial institution would, in that they would evaluate the loan that would be made. They would evaluate the creditworthiness of the customer, And then they would come to a conclusion and say, we'll write a loan guarantee for this, or we'll back the transaction in some way.
And there's been some political discourse about whether or not this is corporate welfare or is this a positive thing. Could you walk me through some of that?
Sure. The proponents of the bank would say that the U.S. Export-Import Bank is necessary because at least 59 other countries have a similar agency, generally referred to as an export credit agency. And without it, American companies are at a competitive disadvantage. Well, the bank's critics will say that it's not much more than corporate welfare, that companies like GE, Boeing, Caterpillar benefit from government financial assistance when there are plenty of other financing alternatives available. And they also say that it puts the taxpayers at risk. Should any of the loans default, then taxpayers are on the hook for it.
And there's a local tie when it comes to this bank.
Yes. The local ties are not only General Electric Company, which says it's going to cut 350 jobs in Waukesha because it's moving the work to Canada that has a strong export credit agency. That's one particular local tie, and it's a very compelling one. The other local ties are dozens of Wisconsin businesses that have used export credit financing from the bank. And again, they make the argument that if the financing isn't available, they're at a competitive disadvantage against Canada and, you know, these other 59 countries that have a similar agency.
And it's at kind of a stalemate right now, yes?
Yes. It's basically stalled out in Congress. The Senate has more or less given its approval. The House of Representatives has been deadlocked on it, and there's an effort to force a vote on it very soon, and hopefully the proponents say that it would be reopened again, because the bank has been shut down since the end of June.
If it reopens, is there a possibility of the jobs that are being lost in Waukesha remaining in Wisconsin?
GE says that's not the case, that its decision was final, it had waited long enough, and it's moved on, and the work is being sent to Canada.
Hard. So when you're reporting on a story like this, obviously you have a lot of details that you have to keep track of in terms of the way the bank functions or doesn't function, what's going on in politics, but you also have this personal tie to it with 350 people losing their jobs. How do you balance both of those elements when you're reporting on it and when you're writing this story?
I think you always have to keep the jobs right at the forefront of your reporting, because these are people who, through no fault of their own, have been swept up in this debate, and their lives are hugely affected by the outcome of it.
To find out more about this bank, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com/business. Even the most casual Bucks fan will have seen their new uniforms, not to mention their new alternative court. But what's the reaction been to both things? Here's Charles Gardner and Matt Velasquez with more.
Yeah, but, so but you were talking about, you know, Gus Johnson and in his comments on the new Bucks, different Bucks. You know, you were in the house for Fan Fest on Saturday when they unveiled the alternate uniforms and the alternate court, which no one in the NBA does. And so yes. I have some, you know, opinions on that, but I want to hear, you know, kind of what you thought seeing those things in person and hearing the reactions from the fans over at the Bradley Center.
Well, I think the fans liked it. The only uniform, black uniform, was a Bengal was wearing it, right? So it'll be fun to see when they come out and actually the players have those uniforms. And these are the Adidas uniforms. And what I've been told is they're pretty scarce right now. I don't think you can find one around town right now, but eventually you will be able to. And Bengal might have been wearing one of the few uniforms. But I think they look sharp. Obviously, they're different. Not having the Milwaukee letters across, but just the Bucks, the deer logo and the number. And so I think they're very sharp. One thing that's interesting for fans to know is they will be worn for four home games, and they're going to have these Fear the Deer nights where they will wear these uniforms. I think the first one is against the Clippers in December. And I was told that will be the first time they wear them. But they also can wear these jerseys on the road, much as they wore those Christmas jerseys. You remember those, Matt? I wasn't a big fan of those red Christmas jerseys.
They don't really do anything for me. They're not bad. They just kind of existed.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of those. And I think these will be much better, and they will wear these on the road. I can't remember how, but I think it's maybe up to 12, 14 times. I don't know the exact number, but I've been told they will not wear them on the road until they've had that first home game. But now this becomes the alternate. And if you're talking that jersey against the red ones, I think this is very sharp and an improvement. And by the way, Matt, I thought the green Rhodes, which made their debut, the new ones last night in Chicago, they look sharp.
Yeah, I mean, these new uniforms, I mean, I don't know exactly what everybody, you know, in the public thinks about them, but when I've talked to other people in the business and I've, you know, kind of looked at other sites where they critique, you know, team uniforms and logos, they're getting high marks. I mean, people seem to like what the Bucks are doing. I know I do. I like the new logo. I have friends who don't live in Milwaukee, who have no reason to ever pay attention to the Bucks, you know, who have said, oh man, like, you know, you cover the Bucks, I love that new logo, I love those new jerseys, you know, who, you know, I have to take them at face value because they have no reason to be saying that other than they actually must like what's going on. And I think the new logo and the new jerseys and the alternate court, I think those are signs of what the ownership is trying to do with this team. They're trying to market the heck out of this team and do things that make them unique, make them interesting. You know, we got an email earlier this week that they're upgrading, you know, the fan experience at a couple different, you know, clubs and areas of the Bradley Center. You know, so they want to get out of that building, but while they're there, they're going to put the money in to make the fan experience better, to upgrade the fan areas so that they can, you know, have new exciting experiences. They're not just going to kind of leave that building alone. If they're going to be there, they want people to come and they want to give them reasons to come. And I think in addition to, you know, with these Fear the Deer nights they're having, you know, I think that's a very solid marketing strategy. Get those four games where they're going to wear those jerseys, where if you want to, you know, check out that alternate court that they're going to play on, you've got to go to those games.
And, yes. Right.
And, you know, since you don't see that around the NBA, you know, it creates buzz. I mean, it creates, you know, a story that national outlets, you know, like ESPN and Fox and all the other national, you know, outlets, they want to pick up. They're going to spread that around and say, hey, you know, the Bucks are doing this new and different thing. And obviously they'll have opinions whether they like it or not. But I don't think I've heard any bad ones. So far with what the new owners are trying to get going and the ways that they're trying to, you know, market to this team.
That came to us from this week's Bucks podcast. You can find that on the sports tab of our website, as well as in iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Sadly, there was no JS on Politics show this week, so we don't have that segment available to you. If you're interested in reading more of our political coverage, Daniel Bice did have an online chat. You can find that at jsonline.com/politics. Thanks so much for joining me today. For our avid listeners, I'm out next week taking a bit of a vacation, so we'll have a break from our show, coming back on Sunday, October 25th, with more.